I am very excited to be speaking for the next few minutes with a wonderful writer by the name of Tim Wendel, with whom I've had the pleasure before of speaking on the morning show. On that particular occasion, it was talking about a book called High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. Tim Wendel has a number of other fine books to his credit, including Summer of 68 and a number of works of fiction as well. What we have before us today is a marvelous historical novel called Rebel Falls. And it is based on historic events which actually occurred towards the end of the war between the states. And it is a book which is full of incredible suspense and intrigue, and also vibrant human characters that radiate from the page. And it is an extraordinary book about courage on a kind of battlefield, if you will, that we do not often think about in terms of the Civil War. We so often spend our time focusing on the great and terrible epic battles on the battlefield, if you will. But this is actually a story of espionage, of a spy working on behalf of the Union to thwart what could have been a tragically effective gain for the South at a time when, in so many other ways, their fortunes were waning. It is a story, as I said, based on historical events, but very seldom explored in the common histories that we read about this period in our history. This book, this novel, Rebel Falls, is published by Three Hills, an imprint of Cornell University Press. And its author, Tim Wendel, is writer in residence at Johns Hopkins University. Tim Wendel, we welcome you to the morning show.
Great to be back with you, Greg. This is going to be great. It'll be fun.
I'm excited to speak with you. I wonder if we could just talk, first of all, about the fact that when we look at your resume and this impressive list of books that you've written, that you dwell both in the world of fiction and nonfiction. Can you just talk for a moment about that and about the way in which both these kinds of writing coexist so neatly in your life?
I'd love to. I don't know about neatly, Greg, but they do coexist, so that's good. I think in many ways, and I tell my students this at Johns Hopkins too, my grad students, because I teach both fiction and nonfiction there, is often what makes a story, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, come alive on the page, at least in my opinion, is the setting, the characters, in a sense even the sequence of events, the plot. And I research a lot, whether I'm doing nonfiction or fiction, and then I kind of come to this crossroads where I need to decide what's the best way to tell this story, what's the most effective way to use, in a sense, this material, this information I've come up with. And if I can stay with my characters, and it's maybe a little bit easier with nonfiction, because if you've got another question to ask, you know, we were talking, it's great to be back with you, after doing High Heat years ago, say when I was doing High Heat, if I had more questions about the fastball at that point, I was able to reach out to Bob Feller, he was still alive, talk with Nolan Ryan, etc. It's maybe a little bit different, obviously, with fiction, because often either if you're doing historical fiction, those characters are long gone. And as you pointed out, several of the characters in Rebel Falls are based on true people. But in a sense, then you need to ask the questions. You put them a little bit out there in the ether. Just to say, I talk to my characters in fiction, too. I need to know their motivation. I need to know why they're doing certain things, like the major protagonist in Rebel Falls, a young woman named Rory Chase. Why is Rory doing this as opposed to this? And I'll interview them, you know, and I'll often do it a little bit out loud. I mean, I'm not yelling, but it's a great way to be left alone. I mean, people kind of think you're kind of losing it a little bit, and then you can kind of get out the Ouija board and have some interesting conversations with whether they be ghosts or shadows or whatever, and really make them come alive.
Hmm. Unlike some nonfiction writers that I've talked to who really have areas of specialty who seem to be drawn again and again to, for instance, the American Civil War or to other periods in our history or other periods in other countries or whatever, but drawn to themes again and again. Whereas when we survey the nonfiction that you have written, it's all over the board. So is there anything in particular that guides you to particular topics that you explore, for instance, when you're writing nonfiction, but also your fiction as well?
Sure. My wife, bless her heart, is a really great writer. She's a very successful ghostwriter. And when certain topics, whether it be the espionage war along our northern border with Canada in 1864, or maybe it's chasing who could throw a baseball the fastest, you know, I'll get on these topics and I'll get a little bit obsessive where I'm talking about them maybe too much at the dinner table. It's kind of night after night after night. And bless her heart, she'll say it after this has gone on for a little bit, not too long. She'll go, well, if you're that fascinated with it, maybe it's time you wrote about it. And then I'll dive in and do a little bit more of the research and kind of do this back and forth between I research for a while, then I write, and then I write. And if I feel it's not, you know, if it's not dynamic enough, then I'll go back and research some more. But I had a good friend of mine, too, another writing friend, a guy named Howard Mansfield. Years ago, I was doing a book on cancer docs who turned the tide against childhood leukemia. I had a brother with childhood leukemia, you know, way back, you know, decades ago. And I started in on that, and I really felt, ooh, I'm over my head now. I don't know medicine. I was having a very difficult time reading clinical trials and papers, for example. And I got in a conversation with him, and I said, Howard, I think I've hit the cul-de-sac. I don't know what I'm doing. And he just kind of started laughing. He said, you're doing what you always do. And I went, well, what do I always do? Because I'm not sure here. And he said, often your work is about underdogs or an underdog and somebody who's battling against great odds and potentially overcomes it. And I went, oh, thank you. You know, this is why it's great to have good friends in your corner. And at that point, if you look at it through the prism of that, where I'm kind of looking at either teams or individuals, or in this case, characters of the Civil War, where the odds are very much against them, and it's up to them to try to do the improbable, if not the impossible, then it does make some sense. At least it does to me, and I kind of move ahead with the next project from there.
Before we delve into some of the specifics in terms of this newest book, Rebel Falls, take us inside your decision to, well, first of all, we should find out how you even first found out kind of about the basic subject matter. But I'm also curious about your decision to tell this incredible story in a novel versus in a work of nonfiction. Can you help us understand what your process of thinking was in making that intriguing choice?
Sure, Greg, I'd be happy to. There was several Confederate spies along our northern border in like 1863, 1864, and they were trying to create an international incident that would potentially bring in England, other European powers, and in a sense, save the Confederacy. As you mentioned in the opening, by 1864, things were going very much against the South. And the one guy's named John Yates Bell, he actually went to the University of Virginia, was a law student, very much a Southern sympathizer. Another guy was a guy named Bennett Burley, who was from Scotland, kind of a soldier for hire, kind of a real rogue. And they were real life guys. And I stumbled across both their names and a little bit about this plan and this conspiracy along the northern border. They're mentioned very briefly in Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, because Abraham Lincoln did not pardon John Yates Bell. And it was kind of surprising because Lincoln tended to pardon almost everybody. And then they were also mentioned even more briefly in Carl Sandburg's Lincoln. Now, I love reading endnotes and such and going, well, hang on, look at these guys. But as soon as I heard about the situation with the northern border, I became more intrigued because I grew up near Niagara Falls, and I love Niagara Falls. I mean, I went there a lot as a kid, and simply because I had grown up in that part of the world and somewhat a history buff, I went, whoa, hang on, what more is here? And then you start the research. Then you start spinning it out. I found actually John Yates Bell's papers at the Cornell Library. Bennett Burley, his papers are at the London Library in London, England, et cetera. So you start getting a mass of an intriguing maybe story. Now you hit the point, what's the best way to tell it? Who's your major player or protagonist? And I wanted somebody who was very, say, patriotic or nationalistic from the Union side, but had a difficult time getting into the fight, so to speak. And at that point, I'm thinking, well, it's probably going to have to be a woman, because any guy who wanted the fight on either side, because it was such a killing fields out there, they would just enlist and probably mowed down, you know, in a couple of weeks as cannon fodder or something. So I was starting to think, well, we could do a woman. And then I was going, I wanted to be a woman that can take us inside what I feel is the second most powerful family, or even the most powerful family at that time in America. And that's the Seward family out of Auburn, New York. William Seward is Secretary of State. People felt in 1860 he was probably going to win the Republican nomination. Then he's edged out by this newcomer named Abraham Lincoln. And to Seward's credit, he really supports Lincoln. He's a very much a big part of that cabinet. Obviously, people know he goes on later and buys Alaska from the Russians. Very dynamic, you know, thinker. And I'm going, oh, I'd love to be kind of inside that household and that kind of train of thought. How can I get there? And William Seward, Secretary Seward, had one daughter who was very much, very much his confidant, Fanny Seward, who actually, as his wife becomes more ill, becomes, in a sense, the Seward family hostess in Washington, D.C. She's the one who puts together the party. She's the one who knows Lincoln. She's the one who can go into the White House unannounced. And once I start, okay, there we go. There's the avenue that can get me into, you know, scenes potentially with Lincoln, that gets me into what's going on in Washington, what's going on in the cabinet. So why don't we have a childhood friend of Fanny Seward's named Rory Chase? She is made up, but she's a composite of several real-life characters, who's maybe grown up on the wrong side of the tracks in Auburn, New York, yet has been befriended by Fanny, and they go way back. And that's when things started to take off, that Rory is, you know, somewhat of a wallflower at the dance. You know, she's kind of a tomboy. You know, she is, she can be aggressive. She's a sharpshooter, et cetera. And yet she's got this very powerful friend in Fanny Seward that can bring us inside, in a sense, all the doings that's going on in Washington. And at that point, you're going, okay, let's go with it and see what Rory can do when she's got to go toe-to-toe in a world of espionage and spies with the likes of John Yates Bell and Bennett Burley.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Tim Wendell about his newest book, a splendid historical novel called Rebel Falls, based on actual events, largely obscure, which involve Confederate spies on our northern border, hoping to stir up trouble that might undermine the Union, that might exacerbate the war weariness that was already very much in place, and with very much the possibility of turning the tide at a point when that was very, very much necessary for a Confederate victory to be won. I really appreciate the fact that your novel is set at this point in the war when, in so many respects, it is a conflict tilting towards the Union, but there is still the possibility that things could turn around. And at one point in the novel, you kind of spell out the way in which what was going to be necessary for this war to be won by the Union. And that was, to win the war, we, meaning the Union, must retake the South. Whereas for the Confederates to win, they didn't need to, in a sense, conquer the North. It would be a different kind of victory, but it would be a victory all the same. Can you just summarize that really interesting scenario about, in a sense, two different kinds of victory being sought by the Union versus the Confederacy?
Oh, sure, Greg. Yeah, I'd be happy to. And in that kind of, in a sense, game plan or philosophy by the North, that in a sense the South had to be retaken, was something that only really came to them after we were already a couple years into the war. I mean, 1861, 1862 was more like, oh, this is going to be over quick. And certainly Bull Run, First Manassas ruled that out, and it became much more entrenched. And I think the one who understood that, maybe even more so than Lincoln on the Union side initially, was Grant. I mean, it was going to have to be war, you know, for all its, you know, devils and ghosts and everything. It was going to have to be scorched earth. And once they bring him back east after his victory at Vicksburg, that's the way the war starts to become. It almost becomes very much a foreshadowing of World War One, you know, with trench warfare and everybody's locked down and it's sieges and such. You're right. The South was had a completely different game plan. And Robert E. Lee knew that almost from the get-go. It was, in a sense, can we play this out long enough so that the North becomes just sick of the war? In a sense, you had a rising group called the Copperheads, which were willing to make peace with the Confederate States and let them be their own nation. And Lee knew it was much more of, you know, in a sense, have a battle here, hit them here, do that. And what he was trying to do often was get some degree of recognition from England primarily, but the European powers were watching this a great deal. Why? Because of cotton. When the Civil War begins, one in every five factory workers in England was somehow involved in the textile or the cotton industry. Cotton was huge to them. And so they would have loved at some point, even though slavery had already been abolished in England, to kind of come in as a power broker and kind of say, well, you know, hang on, why don't you guys just, we'll sort this out. And the Confederate States and some entity will survive and we'll still get our cotton. And in a sense, that's what Lee was trying to do, get a major win, a major battle that would, in a sense, allow England to kind of recognize the South as its own nation. Ironically, at the same point in time, Lincoln is desperate for a Union victory that would allow him to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So you got kind of both armies, unfortunately, you know, at a great loss of life at times, almost playing a PR game in a way that they can say, yeah, okay, we got a big victory, we can do that. And you look at some of the tactics that both sides used, you know, with the Battle of Antietam, pretty much a draw, but it's enough of a victory that Lincoln can issue the Emancipation Proclamation. You look at the Battle of Gettysburg, where, again, it's Lee kind of coming up doing, in a sense, a flanking maneuver into the North. Let's strike the North, but you're absolutely right. I don't have to conquer the North. What I need to do is get them apprehensive, put them on their heels, maybe get recognition from England. And you look at his tactics the last day or so at Gettysburg, Pickett's charge, things like that. It's not so much somebody who's a great tactician, in my opinion. It's somebody who's trying to get a PR victory. It's somebody who's going, okay, yeah, okay, this is where England maybe will come in. And it's interesting because so much of the world was watching our Civil War. And there's a great book called A World on Fire by Amanda Foreman. And she really kind of shows how these events were being played out, mostly in England, but also in Europe, and how they almost brought these countries in, both in a diplomatic sense, but also potentially in a strategical and an army sense. And if that had happened, we, in a sense, that world on fire almost ignited the First World War,
wow,
you know, many years before the next one.
Wow.
And so, you know, and it's all like people kind of, you know, using these vast armies in very, as you point out, in very different ways. The Union realizes we've got to conquer the South, or we're never going to win this. Whereas the South is saying, no, you know, a couple epic victories here. Maybe we turn the tide on the third day at Gettysburg, and that brings England in. And now we're safe. We can be our own nation.
I want to ask you about one other intriguing passage, which occurs early in the novel. And I don't remember now who it is, in a sense, we're sort of hearing from. But you know, we should mention that the novel is essentially told in the voice of your main character, Rory Chase. But at one point, we read these words: 4 long years. That's how long the war had been going on. Shiloh, Second Bull Run, Antietam, Fredericksburg, Chancellorsville, Vicksburg, Gettysburg, Chattanooga, Wilderness, Cold Harbor. Each a nightmare unto itself. Each tragedy chipping away at the best intentions any of us once held. Can you explain the intriguing final sentence? Each tragedy chipping away at the best intentions any of us once held.
Well, Greg, the best intentions, and it's funny, when you read that, I think of Lincoln in a lot of ways. I think of the general populace overall that went through this long, hard slog. I mean, more casualties in the Civil War than any other our other wars. And yet, we were able to find our way through. And I think a lot of that goes to the resiliency and the extreme patience, I guess, in the White House of Lincoln. And one of the things I had up on my wall when I was writing Rebel Falls was I had like one of the early photograph of Lincoln taken by Matthew Brady right after he gave the House Divided Cannot Stand speech in New York. And gosh, he looks like he just stepped out of the, you know, cornfields in Illinois, and he probably kind of did. Whereas the other photo I had up was the one roughly a couple weeks before he's assassinated, and he just looks like he's been carrying the weight of the world on his shoulders forever. I mean, the face is lined, you know, there's bags under the eyes, and yet he didn't allow, in a sense, his guard down. He sealed the deal. He carried us through. And I think in a lot of ways, just, you know, there's many more battles you can list there, but each one of those was a huge tragedy. And yet they come in week after week, day and sometimes day after day. And the perseverance of Lincoln especially, but also, say, his cabinet that fought like cats and dogs, and Seward's a part of that. They carried us through. And I think in some ways that's, and I would throw in Grant too, there was a certain mindset there saying, in a sense, if we can get through to the other end, it's going to be worth it. And to do so, we're going to have to go through a nightmare. And the Civil War very much was. But it's amazing when you look back at that and you take the romantic element a little bit out of the Civil War, you kind of wonder how people did it. Everybody from Lincoln on down to whoever is like the next group up in the infantry on either side. It's an amazing, not just battle of culture, you know, weaponry, whatever. It's also an amazing mental battle that somehow, you know, both sides just went so toe-to-toe over this for so long.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Tim Wendell about his newest book, a historic novel called Rebel Falls. Your novel begins at a burial, the burial of your main character, Rory Chase's uncle, her uncle Frank, really the last member of her immediate family. And so it is, of course, a very despondent scene. By the next scene, Rory has taken, in a sense, matters into her own hands in terms of where she's going to go and what she's going to do with her life. And it's really remarkable the way that this is written. I don't know how much you want to, in a sense, reveal. I enjoyed being surprised by it. I thought for a moment that the narration had shifted to an entirely different character, and in one sense it had. But it's a beautiful foretaste of what is going to stretch ahead for Rory Chase. Tell us about how the novel begins, and then where you rather suddenly and dramatically take us.
Sure, Greg. The opening scene is the local cemetery in Auburn, New York, which is within walking distance of the Seward House. It's still there. I was at the Seward House several times doing research for Rebel Falls. And at one point, one day, just got wandering up into these little hills above the town. And here's this cemetery. And I'm realizing, oh, my God, the Seward family's buried here. And da-da-da-da. And I went, wow, this would be an interesting, it'd be a great place to start, simply because it kind of shows, as you say, it opens with a funeral, but, you know, how do you react at such crossroads? And in a sense, Rory reacts with a great deal of resiliency. She decides to move ahead and, if anything, reinvent herself. And I think that's often what maybe traumatic events or episodes in our world do. They really call into question what we're about. And are we going to maybe try to be something different, be a different type of person? And she does, not to give away too much, but for a while she joins the Union Army. And again, this is based somewhat on real life event. There was a woman named Sarah Edmonds who joined the Union Army out of Michigan. She was in the 2nd Infantry and became like a courier. She fought on the front lines, etc. And then we realize now, and she actually put out a kind of a small book, and she explains a little bit in 1863, late in 1863, she's still with the Union Army, why she can't do it anymore. She's like losing her mind. And we realize, you know, with our current modern day viewpoint, she's suffering from PTSD. But of course, they didn't have that. They didn't know what that was about in the 1860s. So she leaves. In a sense, Sarah Edmonds leaves the Union Army. She deserts. And years later, after the war is over, she becomes a little bit stretched for money, and she files papers to get her pension, which you're not going to get if you're a deserter. But she did, and to do so, she had to reveal that she had disguised herself as a man and joined the Army. And she ended up getting her pension. I mean, everything worked out. But in the course of that, her case became so public, we're now talking, you know, like 1880s, 1890s, that quite a few women stepped forward on both sides of the struggle, of the Civil War, both on the North and the South, and said, yes. Mm. You know, in a sense, I joined the Army, too. Mm. And again, it's mind-boggling what traumatic incidents will force other, you know, force people to take extreme measures. And I think we see that time and time again in the Civil War.
And we certainly do in this story of Rory Chase. And when she is asked at one point, why did you do this in terms of enlisting in the Union Army? I mean, impersonating a male soldier. Why did you do this? Her simple answer, I did it to honor my family. They deserve better.
Yes.
Of course, you could say that about anyone killed in this ungodly war. Ultimately, when she returns home and is able to speak with family friend William Seward, who is also Secretary of State, her plaintive plea to him is, all I know is that I cannot stay here. I need to do something. And William Seward, in his wisdom, sees potential in this young woman, that there is something very significant that she can do on behalf of the Union forces. Explain that possibility. I mean, what was it about Rory Chase that might equip her to actually serve the union in this really important way?
Well, I think in a lot of ways what Seward, what Secretary of State Seward saw in Rory Chase was a person who was very capable and willing to take chances. One of my beta readers who read this said, I really enjoy Rory Chase because she's at that dilemma where she not only learns how to follow orders, but she's got to learn how to break rules. And that's, you know, that's almost the mark of a great spy. And I think the other reason Seward kind of involves her with this whole espionage thing that, again, is real life that was taking part on the border is his daughter very much has his ear. And his daughter is the one saying somewhat, you know, she'll do a good job. You know, you ought to give her a shot. And so that brings Rory to Niagara Falls initially and then what's going on there. And what people don't realize is we tend to think about, and I do, and I can say this, I married a Canadian. Canada seems so at times benign or innocent and what, it's the longest unguarded border in the world and all this type of stuff. But during the Civil War, it was quite the nest of spies on both sides, and the Confederates were there first. And they had a lot of money, and they had some audacious plans, you know, to move against the North through there. And in fact, when you jump ahead just a little bit, the whole plot to first kidnap Lincoln, this was the plot before, obviously, before he was assassinated, was generated out of Canada. It was coming out of Toronto and to a large extent Montreal. And now to jump forward even a little bit more, when John Wilkes Booth is pulled out of that barn in Port Royal, Virginia, where he's been shot after being on the run for 12 days after assassinating Lincoln, they empty his pockets and they find, you know, typical stuff, you know, pocket knife, blah, blah, blah. But the one thing that they just threw, you know, the authorities was there was a banknote from a bank in Montreal. And you're going, oh. And in a sense, a lot of the money was being laundered from, it would go from Richmond up into Canada and then be used for a lot of these plots against the North there. Hmm.
At one point in this conversation between William Seward and young Rory Chase, Seward says, we are desperate for more eyes and ears. Was that, in fact, the case? I mean, was the Union at an alarming deficit when it came to this kind of intelligence work, and particularly in that part of the conflict that is our border with Canada?
Yes, and the Confederates were ahead in the game. Not only did they have men and manpower spies, pretty much going from Halifax all the way past Detroit, they had a lot more money in the game too, and they had an ingenious, as I said, laundering system where they were able to get it out of Richmond, and then if they got it into Canada, they had a organization called the Northwest Conspiracy that was very well entrenched and had been, say, starting from like 1863, and so the Union was behind. And so this is why it's not that much of a leap of faith that Secretary of State Seward is desperate to use somebody like Rory Chase, who's inexperienced, you know, maybe even held there a decade as a woman, et cetera. He's desperate for help there, as that segment pointed out. And things kind of ratchet up. And the other thing that they did that I think was a little ingenious that the North pulled out was obviously in the years before the war, you had the Underground Railroad, and you had some sites up there that obviously the Underground Railroad's not being used now that the war has been started, not that much, obviously, but they were still there. And one of them was a great place that was for real called the Cataract House Hotel in Niagara Falls. Oh, just an amazing place. Pretty much totally African-American staff did a heroic job in the Underground Railroad years, what was called the war before the war. And Seward and others in the cabinet, somewhat activated these again. Now, again, they're behind, you know, I'm making a little bit of a leap of faith, you know, how important they were. But once I found, you know, instances about the Cataract House, the amazing wait staff that they had, that they had this rowboat always down on the Niagara River in the years, the war before the war, ready to ferry escaped slaves or freedom seekers across the Niagara River, I went, wow, you know, I've got to use this in some way. Mm-hmm. And so in my book, I have Seward turning to them because, again, he's desperate for help.
One choice you make that I think is really interesting, and I applaud the choice, by the way, is the way in which you portray the two primary Confederate spies, that is John Yates Bell and Bennett Burley. And I think one choice that you could have made was to paint them very much as monstrous villains. I mean, as just sinister forces on the side of evil, or however you'd want to put it. And in fact, you, I think, craft your portrait of these two men who actually lived, who actually were Confederate spies. You craft that those portraits, I think, much more carefully, in a sense, much more sensitively. Not that we're exactly rooting for them, of course, but we see them as fully formed human beings. And could you just talk a moment about the historic record that exists about these two men and what you drew from that record in order to craft your portrayal of them in the way that you do?
I'd be happy to. They're, as you say, Craig, they're amazing individuals and real-life folks. And you're walking a line there as a writer because, you don't, as you say, you don't want to make them total monsters, yet I don't want to make them heroes, and yet I want people to understand their motivation. John Yates Bell was very much, he was from where Charlestown, West Virginia is now. At that point, he was part of Virginia. Went to UVA Law School for a couple years. Didn't graduate. And he kept maybe avoid the war a smidge, but the war always brought him back in. And finally, to a certain point, he just embraced its madness. He was part of Stonewall Jackson's Stonewall Brigade for a little bit till he was wounded. It seems pretty apparent he witnessed a couple years earlier John Brown's hanging at Harper's Ferry and very much wanted to be involved. He believed in the South. He believed in slavery. He believed in a sense, this way of life and was ready to give his life to try to preserve it. And he was quite the orator too, which I was able to use somewhat, you know, in Rebel Falls. You know, he enjoyed the theater and would kind of use his voice at certain times as a leader, you know, with his men and such. Bennett Burley is, as I said earlier, he's a rogue. He's a soldier of fortune, was one of many hundreds, maybe thousands of young men from around the world who were kind of attracted by the Civil War like moth to a flame, not so much because they had any type of philosophical argument one way or the other. They just wanted to be kind of where the show was. And so he came from Glasgow. He was already in a bad marriage and came to the United States, came to America and almost flipped a coin about which side he was going to go join. Ends up joining the South, hits it off with John Yates Bell. They're bosom buddies. And it takes off from there. And one of the things that blew my mind, Greg, is in doing the research on Bennett Burley, John Yates Bell doesn't make it till the end. I mean, he's hung, and we perhaps this is something that really angered John Wilkes Booth. They knew each other, and that Booth was very upset, potentially, that Lincoln hadn't pardoned Bell. But Burley escaped, and Burley went back to England, reinvented himself as a newspaper man, and became like the foreign war correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph for the next several decades. He covered like the Korean War. He covered like the Boer War. I mean, you know, it's bizarre to go into a place like the London Library And suddenly you're seeing, hang on, there's Bennett Burley's, here's his account, dispatch from here. Here's his account, you know, of this war episode, you know, in totally different places. And ironically, he died just before World War One broke out, which if anybody was born to cover World War One, it was probably Bennett Burley.
Fascinating. Without going into too much detail, tell us a little bit about the plot which they were a part of, and to what extent what we read about that in your novel is a reflection of actual history, and what was it they hoped to accomplish in this plot?
Well, their timing couldn't have been any better, Greg. I mean, what Bell and Burley, in a sense, what the Confederate Northwest Conspiracy was looking to do was seize the USS Michigan, which was a Union warship, and pretty much it was the only one left on the Great Lakes. Why is that? Everything else is along the Atlantic seaboard, again, where we think the war, all the wars taking place, blockading the South, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, the North can't win the war until it brings the South to its knees, and part of that is the blockade. And so one of the things, and I find it kind of genius in a madman's kind of way, the Confederates figured out, they said, well, if we can get this warship, which was the first iron-hulled, you know, side steamer on the Great Lakes, if we can get that, we can do a lot of havoc. And it plays somewhat back to the war fatigue, too. And their timing was to try to seize this roughly late September into October of 1864. Why is the timing right? Because here comes the presidential election. And even though we look now back at history and we see Lincoln wins it decisively in the Electoral College over George McClellan, at that point in time, everybody thought it was going to be very, very close. Within the Lincoln cabinet, Seward thought they would barely win. Lincoln had kind of revealed to his secretaries, John Hay and et cetera, that I'm probably going to lose. This is it. You know, McClellan's going to come in here and make peace with the South, and, you know, I failed. And so it was in those weeks leading up to the election, being perceived as very close. And just think how devastating, and again, we're back to a PR thing somewhat, if Confederates get hold of a warship and do some damage along, say, the southern shore of Lake Erie. At that point, it was anchored off Sandusky. And that maybe is enough to, you know, turn the electoral vote. And so, in a way, what the Confederates are up to was, you know, evil genius in a way. And it, you know, and almost worked.
It sure did. So we, of course, leave it to our listeners to explore your book in more detail and follow the incredible exploits of Rory Chase as she does this incredibly dangerous work on behalf of the Union. You tell it in such wonderful fashion. It is such a suspenseful story. Let's finish by talking about the backdrop of the most dramatic events of your novel, namely Niagara Falls. If I remember correctly, you are originally from that area, and I should think it was gave you tremendous pleasure to set so much of this novel in a place that I suspect you really love.
Very much. I mean, it was maybe the great joy in doing Rebel Falls was to not only revisit Niagara Falls, but be thinking about, you know, the visits I took with my father there, took with my grandfather. Actually, there used to be an old family hotel, obviously many years before me, right there with the Wendell Hotel, supposedly was in Niagara Falls, even though it's been, everything's been leveled. And I think one of the things I love about, you know, I think it's Adora Welty writes about the importance of setting or scene and how you're trying to involve it in a very basic but fundamental way. And if the story can be imagined anywhere in a way, according to Welty, it's failed. You know, setting needs to be identified, needs to be concrete. You need to be able to feel it, taste it, smell it. And you know, I know Niagara Falls. I grew up, like I say, only 15, 20 miles away from there. And one of the things that I loved doing with Rebel Falls was, here you got this amazing backdrop, one of the wonders of the world, and I still think it is, despite, you know, some of the honky-tonks and the way it looks. But it's still an amazing, free view, overwhelming splendor. And yet, at this particular moment in our nation's history, it was one of the potential tipping points, a real struggle between arguably good and evil. And it's happening in one of our most picturesque landmark settings in our country. Hmm. And once I got into that, I was like, yeah, let's go. And it allowed me, I guess, to show my love for that part of the world, which, you know, anytime my wife teases me, anytime I get within, I don't know, 100 miles of Niagara Falls, yeah, we're probably going.
Well, your love of that amazing, wondrous landmark is very evident, as is also your love of the character at the heart of your novel, Rory Chase. At one point, as she is first talking to William Seward, desperate to be a part of the Union's effort, she says, "I can do more than make bandages, I'm sure of it." And of course, all that she is capable of unfolds in thrilling fashion in your novel. The book again is Rebel Falls, a novel, published by Three Hills, an imprint of Cornell University Press, and the author, Tim Wendell. Tim Wendell, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, my pleasure, Greg. And thank you so much for your time and reading Rebel Falls.